from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Venezuela is on the brink. The question is, the brink of what? More entrenched dictatorship? A civil war? Military intervention? Well, opposition leader Juan Guaido called his country to the streets again today. The U.S. and almost every other country in the Americas is backing him over the regime of President Nicolas Maduro. Meanwhile, the suffering continues for average Venezuelans as astronomical inflation, food and medicine shortages, they've all forced millions from the country. U.S. sanctions aimed to curb Maduro's power could be effective, but they could also make the immediate shortages worse. This hour on Point, the still unfolding standoff in Venezuela and a tale of two presidents. And you can join us. How do you think the Venezuela crisis will play out? Is the U.S. taking the right approach? What's your question about what's next for Venezuela? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And let's start first straight off in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. And joining us now via Skype is Joshua Goodman. He's Andean news director for the Associated Press. Joshua Goodman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you, Meghna?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for joining us on what seems to be a very significant day in Venezuela. What's going on in Caracas right now?
Today are the first protests since Juan Guaido, the head of the Congress, declared himself interim president with a reading of the Constitution, which basically says he has to assume the presidency because Maduro is illegitimate. So today people are being asked to basically stop wherever they are at noon, right now actually, and go out to in front of their workplaces, in front of their homes, and just sort of sit in the streets and sort of let it be known that they're there and upset. It's not a huge protest. We're going to see a much larger demonstration planned for Saturday. But it does show, you know, sort of the tense calm that sort of pervades the city right now, trying to see what's going to happen next in this unfolding drama.
Okay, a tense calm. But meanwhile, we have the Venezuelan Supreme Court, freezing Guaido's bank assets, or at least perhaps imposing a travel ban on him?
That's right. They did that yesterday. But I think what's unique here is they've been doing that for a long time to lots of opposition figures whenever they try to leave the country for meetings and whatnot. What's unique here is that they have not arrested Juan Guaido. I think in any other situation in past bouts of unrest, we would have seen that perhaps already. I think what's happened here is the White House has really drawn a red line here and explicitly said that if anything happens to U.S. diplomats or Juan Guaido, it would have very serious consequences. We don't really know what those are, but, you know, obviously President Trump has said all options, including military ones, are on the table. And I think a lot of people expect that, you know, that's really the ammunition that the U.S. has left at this point. They've Right. already sanctioned the country severely. And, you know, the military option is one that's always there lurking.
Well, I mean, we have John Bolton tweeting, "We denounce the illegitimate former Venezuelan Attorney General's threats against, as Bolton calls him, President Juan Guaido." And Bolton then continues his tweet. He says, "Let me reiterate, there will be serious consequences for those who attempt to subvert democracy and harm Guaido." Joshua Goodman, how is President Nicolas Maduro responding to all this, the continued pressure from the United States?
Yeah, he is really sort of recoiling to where he feels most comfortable, which is with support from his military and looking also to especially some of his foreign allies, especially Russia. Russia gave a very strong defense of Venezuela at the United Nations. And in some ways, what we're seeing now is sort of a replay of some of that U.S.-Russian tension that we see in hotspots around the world. And he's also, it has to be said, every day appearing with his troops. Seeing them declare loyalty, him offering his support for them. And, you know, I think that that is sort of what's been missing so far in this crisis. There have been isolated uprisings by sort of units over the past few months, including one just last week. But for the most part, these have been very easily contained. And Maduro, I think, really is relying on that military to stand by him. And quite frankly, you know, at least the top command, which are very well represented in the upper echelons of the government, we've seen very little sign that they're ready to defect. And that sort of suggests to a lot of people that, you know, whatever happens here, it's going to be a drawn out process. It's not going to be something quick and sudden.
Well, Joshua Goodman is the Andean news director for the Associated Press with us from Caracas today. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, as Joshua mentioned, President Nicolas Maduro has gone out of his way to be seen with members of the Venezuelan military. On state TV in Venezuela this morning, Maduro could be seen walking around a military base in Caracas with top commanders and dozens of troops. And he gave them a pep talk.
Unidad monolítica, moral máxima.
And Maduro says, monolithic unity, maximum morality, and for those traitors and mercenaries, we uncover immediate justice. Do you understand? And that's right. And then you just heard a general say, yes, we understand, my leader. And Maduro says, and so it shall be done. So that was today on Venezuelan state TV. Well, joining us now from Bogota, Colombia, is Nick Peyton Walsh. He's senior international correspondent for CNN International. He spent just under a week undercover inside Venezuela. And we have links to his reporting at onpointradio.org. Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. So tell us a little bit more about what you saw in your week undercover inside Venezuela. Were you able to connect with members of the Venezuelan military?
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken during that period of time to two serving soldiers in the lower rank and file, and they basically say the same thing, similar to what Josh has been saying. Look, they share the same discontent of ordinary Venezuelans. You cannot live in that country without being in appalling conditions, frankly. Hyperinflation, scarcity of food, and crime, frankly, makes ordinary life incredibly difficult. These soldiers share the same problems as everybody else. One said, you know, a salary can get me a chicken, and then I've got very little else to spend my money on for the rest of the month. One chicken in a month. So that's a reason why they're all discontent. We heard from another soldier saying, yes, this discontent is quite common. But the difficulty, I think, that they are seeing within those lower rank and file is they're not united. They're not able to coordinate their emotions. And at the same time, their more senior officers, particularly at the general level, who have been very clearly on state television parading their loyalty to Nicolas Maduro since the protests last week, they are still, frankly, making money out of this. They've still got money within the Maduro government coffers to keep that elite kind of content. Will it change if the money starts to run out? Possibly. Are we going to see the possibility of large street protests making those people rethink whether the writing is on the wall or not for the Maduro government? We don't know. But you've got to have a big reality check. And it was helpful to hear Josh say that before. While Juan Guaido is getting a lot of international recognition and being called president, and those people inside the country in the Maduro government are still running the show, really. And the Attorney General is the Attorney General there. He's the one calling the shots for law enforcement rather than the former Attorney General, as John Bolton referred to him. So the bit of reality check is required, and that is essentially the enormous challenge now for the United States policy here. They very quickly moved to recognize Juan Guaido. In fact, one senior White House official telling one of my colleagues at CNN that they hadn't really heard of him about a month ago. Hmm. The question really is, how do they translate this desire for him to be an alternative government and get to him the billions potentially at his disposal and actually enable him to bring humanitarian aid to those inside the country? A huge difference between what Washington is saying he is and what he actually is at the moment. But bear no mistake here, the clock is certainly ticking on the Maduro government. Now their financial resources are possibly in question.
Right. So we'll talk more about the effect of the U.S. sanctions here in a couple of minutes. But Nick, one of the reasons why we were eager to have you on today is, you know, we can do 30,000-foot analysis a lot, but right on the ground in Venezuela, across the country, there is a crisis going on. I mean, you were talking about the profound level of suffering and impoverishment, and you have been reporting on that. I just want to play a little bit of tape here from one of your reports when you visited a profoundly, you know, impoverished neighborhood in Caracas just last week, where in the past in this particular neighborhood, support for President Maduro was high. Now, perhaps not so much. And this is a moment here where you met a mother who has only one egg, just one egg's worth of scrambled eggs left to feed her children.
It was up here, in the normally loyal slums, where the fight was nastiest. Special forces entered these streets. They'd been coming back to make arrests all during the afternoon, when we were invited to meet Carolina's extended family, where Maduro's base has long lived. State handouts bought their loyalty for years. But now this is all she has to feed four this day.
And again, this being just one egg. Nick, I mean, we've got about 2 minutes here before we have to take a break, but please tell us more about what you saw in sort of the lives of everyday Venezuelans.
look, this isn't geopolitical on the ground. This is about hunger and scarcity of food and water. Hyperinflation means you're paying tomorrow's price of the day. It guarantees that people will be able to afford and feed themselves less and less moving forward. It's startling walking around that country and seeing the glorious infrastructure, frankly, of the petrostate rich in the past and people digging out of trash cans. Everybody has a food problem. People who work for the government get a food box, and that keeps their loyalty to some degree. But this isn't really about whether Washington or Moscow prevail. For people on the ground there who'll be on the streets, it's about what they have for their next meal. And it's startling to find, even us with our pretty much unlimited budget, how hard it was simply to get food. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, Nick Payton Walsh there joining us from Bogota, Colombia. He's senior international correspondent for CNN International. He spent under a week just undercover. Sorry, I should say inside Venezuela. Let's take a quick call here before we have to take a break. Let's go to Joseph, who's calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Magna. I'm curious. I mean, of course, we're accustomed to seeing support for the thug dictators by the other thug dictators in the form of China and Russia and so forth. But one of the things that I'm not seeing very much about, and I have many friends in Venezuela, and they're very aware of this, is the influence of Cuba and the Cuban military as part of the security forces down there. I mean, honestly, without Cuba at this moment, even with the vocal support from Russia and China and other authoritarian governments, I don't think Venezuela continues to exist in Maduro's world. And we don't see very much about this, first of all, and I'm wondering what the experience of your guest was relative to that, and whether it's visible down there on a societal scale, or whether people are talking about it, because for years now, Cuba has been lending its security expertise, its advisors, its military people, and that's really what's been able to, in my opinion, to allow Maduro to keep his grip on the military, because it's like a little mini Stasi in Venezuela.
Well, Joseph, I'm going to take it back from you there. And when we come back, we're going to have a couple new guests to help us answer that question. Joseph, thank you so much for your call. We are talking about the crisis in Venezuela and what's next as the tensions continue to rise between a tale of two presidents. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the escalating political and economic crisis in Venezuela and what happens next, and whether or not the United States, in its very vocal and aggressive policy towards Venezuela, is following the right path. And let's listen to a little bit of what National Security Advisor John Bolton and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said when they announced U.S. sanctions on Venezuelan oil companies on Monday. They did that a little earlier this week. Bolton said a couple of things that may or may not be true, but would seem intended to rattle the Venezuelan military and President Nicolas Maduro. He claimed all options are on the table, and in a widely circulated photograph now, the phrase 5,000 troops to Colombia was visible on his yellow notepad that he was holding, that Bolton was holding. He also claims that military officers are already talking quietly to the opposition.
We are also aware of significant contacts between general officers of the Venezuelan military and supporters of the National Assembly. So you may have seen a statement last week by the defense minister, Vladimir Padrino, flanked by a number of generals in uniform. What they didn't know was how many of them were already talking to the National Assembly.
So that's National Security Advisor John Bolton on Monday. Now, the Venezuelan opposition leader, Juan Guaido, the leader that the United States is saying it recognizes, or it is recognizing as the legitimate president of Venezuela, he told Telemundo's José Díaz Balart in an interview on Monday that he does not support foreign military interventions in Venezuela.
Esa ha sido una pregunta recurrente de los últimos días, y es un dilema
Guaido there saying, that's a question that has been recurring in recent days, and it's a difficult dilemma for Venezuela. Do they want to die of hunger as their children cry in the streets and have no education, or an extreme option of using force? We don't want one or the other. That's Juan Guaido. Earlier this week on Telemundo. Well, joining us now is Francisco Toro. He's with us from Montreal. He's a Venezuelan journalist and political scientist, editor of the online journal Caracas Chronicles, and a contributor to the Washington Post as well. Francisco Toro, welcome to the program.
Hi, Magna.
Also with us today is Shannon O'Neill. She's with us from New York. She's vice president and senior fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Shannon O'Neill, welcome to you.
My pleasure.
Okay, so Francisco Toro, let me start with you here. Before the break, you heard Nick Peyton Walsh from CNN saying that from what he's seen, he believes the clock is ticking on the Maduro government. Do you think he's right or not?
I think that's the feeling people in Venezuela have right now, simply because the regime has almost no popular support left at this point. Maybe 10, 15, 20% of hardcore Chavistas still support Maduro. But the regime's real basis of support is fear and the security forces and the military. And it takes money to pay those people. You have to pay the torturers. You have to pay for the torture chambers. You have to pay the spies. And that money largely has been coming from the pockets of your listeners, of U.S. car drivers who go, you know, need gas, pump it, and don't realize that a portion of the money that they're putting into, that they're paying for their gas is making its way back to finance the Venezuelan police state. Those financial flows are now very clearly about to cease.
Right.
And so how you run a police state without money is a question that Nicolas Maduro has never really had to ask himself before.
Okay, so Shannon O'Neill, just to be clear, as Francisco Toro was saying, Venezuelan oil that's sold to Russia or China, for example, is being used to pay off debts that Venezuela has to those countries. But the oil that goes to the United States is a primary source of cash for the Maduro government. Is that right?
It is the primary source. Yeah. We are the ones who, the refineries in the U.S., who pay them cash. There's a question as these sanctions come into place whether or not, one, Venezuela will be able to take that oil and send it elsewhere, send it to China, Russia, India, or other places. And two, whether for that oil they could get cash. So could they replace this? It would definitely be less than the United States has been paying, but could they get some? And so that's a big question with these sanctions.
Okay. And so, but if the sanctions do persist for a while, let's talk, you know, specifically about how long do you think the Maduro government could endure not having that, you know, that primary source of the many millions, if not billions of dollars that it relies on?
Well, I think there are a few other sources of revenue, not nearly as big as the oil, because this really is a petrostate, a state run by oil. There are sources of mining. We have seen some mining products especially go to Turkey, which is a government that still recognizes Maduro. There are allegedly and justifiably a lot of resources coming from drug trafficking, and particularly the military has been involved in this. So there are hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in drug trafficking money. And the other thing that isn't going to the government but is coming back to the Venezuelan people are remittances. And for the 3 million-plus Venezuelans who have left, many are sending back amounts of money to their families or friends that are back there. So there is some money that's circulating in Venezuela that helps at least keep the economy going. And some of those sources are there to prop up the government. But it has been, and Francisco's right, it is really, this is run on the money from oil. So that's the big question.
Okay.
Here.
So Francisco, then let me turn back to you because, again, to be clear, the United States is far from the only Western hemispheric country that is recognizing Guaido, right? I mean, I think virtually every country in the Americas, save for what, Mexico has done the same thing?
That's right. Mexico is one big holdout.
Okay. And so, look, what's your take on this? Do you think the Trump administration thus far, it's being very vocal and very pointed in its support for Guaido. Is it following the best path or not?
Look, Venezuelans have exhausted the resources at their disposal to try to dislodge a regime. There have been big bouts of protesting on the streets in 2014, 2017. They've been met with violence. They've been met with mass jailings, with people getting thrown out of the country or thrown into jail with torture. And so Venezuelans are at the end of their resources. It's clear that we need support from the international community, Colombia, Canada, Peru have been very important in stepping up, Argentina and Brazil as well, and stepping up and supporting the Venezuelan democratic movement. But it's clear that the U.S. has a special role to play in all this because the large refineries designed to handle Venezuelan oil, which is sour, heavy crude oil, are mostly in the U.S. Gulf Coast. That's where they are. If the U.S. doesn't buy Venezuela's oil, it's very difficult to find an alternative market for it because there just aren't refineries designed to handle that kind of oil very much in other places in the world. So I do think that the U.S. is being very aggressive. It's a very risky move. If it doesn't work, there's not a clear plan B. This is not standard diplomatic procedure to recognize a president who doesn't actually run the country. It's very risky and it's very bold, but Venezuelans are very desperate.
Okay, so tell me more about that, that there's no plan B. I mean, what do you mean?
Well, if you go to sort of International Relations 101, one of the first things that they teach you is that you recognize whichever government actually has power. It's not a statement of what you wish was the case. It doesn't mean that you think it's a good government. It just says they run the country. The U.S. recognized the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War. The U.S. recognizes plenty of governments that it doesn't agree with. Here, it's making a break from standard diplomatic practice, along with almost every country in the hemisphere, to recognize a government that they wish was in power. So there's not a lot of precedent for using diplomatic recognition in that way. And if Maduro keeps control of the country for 3 months, 6 months into the future, suddenly you don't have an interlocutor. You don't have anyone to talk to in Caracas because you're recognizing people who don't run the country. That's definitely a risk, and we should be mindful of it.
Okay, so Shannon O'Neill, what do you have to say to that?
I agree. I mean, this is a risky proposition. I do think the Trump administration believes, with the recognition of Guaido, with the sanctions, that this regime will fall. You know, as Francisco put forward, money keeps this regime going. You have to pay these people off. But it is a risky bet because many of these people in power, many of these generals, yes, money matters to keep the machine going, but they also care about other things. I think power is part of this. This is a government where the generals are intricately involved. Many of them are governors or they're ministers. They run the food distribution. They have a lot of power. And I would also say there's a lot of fear for these individuals who have been closely linked to the Maduro regime. While Guaido has said that he'll provide amnesty for those who help with a democratic transition, the United States has not provided such an amnesty or said that they would do that. And many of these have been involved in drug trafficking. They've been involved in corruption and human rights abuses. So there are U.S. courts or international courts, the International Criminal Court, that would prosecute them. So that amnesty is very uncertain for them. So I think there's various factors here. Yes, if the money slows, will they be able to keep this machine going, keep the lower ranks at least somewhat happy? Though, as we heard, they're not particularly happy. But there's other factors here that may keep them circling around Maduro and keep this regime in place for months. And then the United States, as Francisco says, they don't have an interlocutor. Mm. Where do you go next?
Mm. Well, we've got a lot of comments coming in online here. On our website, onpointradio.org, Jeff E. 68 says, the U.S. has a bad history with Central and South America. The next few months are going to be very intense in that regard, and let's hope both houses of Congress keep Trump from dragging the U.S. into another dilemma. On Twitter, John Bernoit says, with the Russia investigation closing in, the Trump administration is under mounting pressure to get a PR win. I fear military intervention in Venezuela is an appealing option as it will distract from problems at home. Well, let's go to Richard, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you. I believe U.S. intervention is necessary at this point. The international community has argued that because Venezuela is a sovereign state, they're not going to intervene. But we're dealing with a criminal state. They do not believe in the rule of law or will answer to any negotiations. Past negotiations have been a joke. And as previous callers said, the Venezuelan military is being controlled by Cuba. So we are already intervened by another state. So in order to save the Venezuelan people, I believe the U.S. and allies should intervene militarily.
Okay. Well, Richard, thank you for your call. Francisco Toro, a couple of things there that Richard's brought up. First of all, since it's been mentioned twice, and perhaps not everyone has a great degree of knowledge on this, how influential is Cuba in the Venezuelan military?
Cuba is enormously influential. And don't take my word for it. Take Hugo Chavez's word for it. He said that Cuba and Venezuela were two countries that had two presidents, but only one revolution and deep down just one government. Cuban intelligence penetration into the Venezuelan security forces is very extensive. The daily intelligence briefings that Nicolás Maduro reads every day are prepared not by Venezuelan analysts, but by Cuban analysts. And this is one reason why it's been so difficult for the Venezuelan military to turn all that discontent into a movement, because they are very intensively spied on. And anyone who gives even a hint of dissent is immediately arrested, often tortured to give up other names. And if they can't be found because they go underground, it has been documented by human rights organizations that they'll round up their family members and torture them to give up their whereabouts. It's very difficult for people under that degree of counterintelligence surveillance to coordinate. And I think that's a problem here, is that the generals are isolated within their own organizations. They've stolen a lot of money. They have a lot to fear. But the people below them, who probably in a large majority don't agree with them, can't coordinate to do something about it.
Okay. Shannon O'Neill, the caller, also mentioned that he was very supportive of the idea of a U.S. military intervention in Venezuela. And, you know, I'm thinking once again to that cryptic note that John Bolton had written on his yellow legal pad saying something like 5,000 troops to Colombia. Now, of course, it is a tool of, you know, international diplomacy or bluster. I don't know what you want to call it, but it's not an unfamiliar stance for the United States to say everything's still on the table. But realistically, is there any appetite for any kind of U.S. military assistance or intervention in Venezuela, any appetite for that in South America at all?
Not when you talk to the other governments around, but we also have to realize, what would a military intervention realistically look like in Venezuela? And I do think some people are hearkening back to the last time the United States went into the region. We're talking Panama or Grenada. These are small countries that had, you know, functioning bureaucracies, functioning states, and they took out a leader, right? Venezuela is not that case. This is a country twice the size of Iraq, with more oil, nearly a similar population, and with a failed state. This is a place where the electricity doesn't work. The sewage systems don't work. You would have to help rebuild this whole country from the bottom. It is also a place with many armed forces. We've been talking a lot about the military, and it has a military. But it has a National Guard. It has militias. It has armed groups in neighborhoods that they call colectivos. It has a lot of people, hundreds of thousands or so, with guns that are loosely affiliated with the government. And so you could see a situation where, if you sent in troops, you would be facing a situation with lots of violence on the ground, no infrastructure, and where you would need to be for many years. So right. Think not Panama, think Iraq, think Afghanistan. And I look at the United States political system, I don't see any appetite for that kind of intervention.
Well, look, President Nicolas Maduro himself on social media today is saying, think Vietnam, right? I mean, he appealed directly to U.S. citizens. I'm seeing reporting here through CNN asking them to stop the Trump administration from turning Venezuela into a Vietnam in Latin America. Francisco Toro, how do you respond to that?
Well, I hope there are enough reserves of common sense in Washington, D.C. to understand that these kinds of threats better not be backed by action, because it's enormously risky and it's very, very easy to come up with disaster scenarios. Venezuela people are so desperate that if you talk to people, that many people say, yes, we want the Marines to come, send Marines. We're very happy to have them. I don't think they actually understand what they're bargaining for. But I also don't think it'll ultimately come to that, because I think this regime, it's really going to end up being about the money. This regime is not sustainable without oil rents and oil sales to the United States. And I don't think it needs to go any farther than that, nor will it.
Okay. Well, so let me ask you, though, say, again, this is all speculation at the moment, but if there was some sort of escalation or a military intervention there, could that not also inadvertently have the effect of rallying support around Maduro?
That will happen for sure. But it'll also draw forces from other countries. Russia has major interests in Venezuela, as does Cuba, as does China. The U.S. would be sucked in, Brazil and Colombia would be sucked in. I actually think the better parallel is Syria. The scary scenario is that Venezuela ends up fragmenting into chunks that are led by different military commanders associated with various foreign powers, and that can go on indefinitely. It would be a catastrophe, and it would really make 2018 look like the good old days. I hope we don't go there.
Well, Francisco Toro and Shannon O'Neill, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about the escalating crisis in Venezuela, a tale of two presidents, as we might put it. Are you Venezuelan? Do you have family there? What is it like there for them? And do you see the Trump administration in the United States as taking the right path or not in its advocacy for opposition leader Juan Guaido? This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the escalating crisis in Venezuela. I'm joined today by Francisco Toro. He's with us from Montreal. He's a Venezuelan journalist and political scientist, editor of the online journal Caracas Chronicles, and a contributor to The Washington Post. Shannon O'Neill is also with us. She's in New York today. She's vice president and senior fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and we want to hear from you. But let's just harken back to last week on Wednesday during the nationwide protest last week. That's when Juan Guaido declared himself interim president of Venezuela at a swearing-in ceremony in front of a crowd of protesters.
Juro! Asumir formalmente las competencias.
And Guaido, the opposition leader there, says, I swear to formally assume the responsibilities of the national executive as president in charge of Venezuela. And he goes on to say he will enact free elections. And once again, as a reminder, Washington and most nations in the Western Hemisphere are recognizing Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela. Well, on the other hand, on Monday of this week, President Nicolas Maduro addressed President Donald Trump in English to demand that Washington keep, quote, its hands off the country.
Donald Trump, con Venezuela, no te metas. Hand off Venezuela. Donald Trump, hands off Venezuela.
That's President Nicolas Maduro earlier this week. And one more voice here, because again, I mean, it's the people of Venezuela who are suffering. Here's a woman in Caracas describing the protests in her neighborhood last week. She's hoping for a change in government. And the sound is courtesy of MSN News. And she says last night there was a protest here. It started at 9. They faced the police, throwing stones, bottles, and police fired tear gas at them. Around 3 a.m., special forces arrived and they shot someone. The woman says she wants a change for Venezuela because I like my country and I don't want to have to leave. She says she has two children to fight for and her husband had to leave a year ago. So one woman in Caracas there. Let's turn to the phones. Dan is calling from Pensacola, Florida. Dan, you're on the air.
Hello. They've had a lot of problems in this country, I guess. The Democrats keep saying that there's foreign collusion, and that's a terrible thing to happen in this country. As far as there's a man there was talking about torture camps and stuff like that. I thought he was talking about Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo for a moment there. A lot of the problems they talk about in Venezuela, you could say about this, our own country, as far as elections, people living in poverty. What is it? 5 out of every 10 children in this country are living in poverty? I mean, really?
So Dan, what are you saying, though? Are you saying that you see some hypocrisy here? What are you saying?
Well, the hypocrisy, I mean, it's on the most grandest scale. And as far as I was in Caracas in 2004 after the coup attempt, I was there and a car bomb went off that killed the attorney general that was investigating that. That was never on U.S. news or anything. The CIA has been spending tens of millions of dollars there every year. That's called warfare. When you're spending that kind of money to destroy a country, that's called warfare. So everyone talking about warfare, the war may start. The war has been going on.
Yeah.
So I don't get it.
Well, Dan, thank you for your call. Francisco Toro, let me turn back to you, because I think Dan is echoing, a point of view that's not uncommon, that, you know, he sees long-term U.S. involvement, whether overt or covert, in Venezuela. And therefore, you know, he's calling out his own government here in Washington as being wildly hypocritical.
Well, I think it's true that point of view is often heard. But the reason it's often heard is that the Venezuelan and Cuban governments have spent 20 years with a sophisticated and expensive propaganda campaign to turn this conflict into a Cold War relic or a Venezuela against the U.S. thing, which it really hasn't been. It's sad because these kinds of propaganda lines that are, as a Venezuelan, they recognize them because they are on state TV every day, and as a journalist, I have to watch state TV. They're repeated again and again and again, and a lot of money is put into making sure that they get into foreign media and people believe them. It's disheartening.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because, look, I'm just looking at sort of the pattern of U.S. involvement in Central and South America over decades. I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility, given how many times we have intervened, we being the United States, in the affairs of the Western Hemisphere. I mean, there is some reason why that, even if it's propaganda, it might resonate with the Venezuelan people, no?
Well, of course, good propaganda has to have a kernel of truth. If it doesn't, it's just silly and nobody takes it seriously. It's very effective because there is a long history to make it effective. So, and the Cuban regime has spent 61 years now, very shrewdly using the missteps of U.S. foreign policy in the region to establish and to enable them to hang on to the Cuban dictatorship, and now to expand into Venezuela and to try to push into places like Bolivia and Nicaragua. And this is a long-term fight. But what I think is that Americans need to realize that, yes, there is propaganda. Yes, there has been U.S. propaganda. But you know who is really good at propaganda is the Cubans. And people aren't cognizant of the degree to which those Cuban operations get picked up and end up in the stream of news thanks to outlets like Telesur, which is the lavishly funded Venezuelan propaganda outlet that pumps out this stuff day in and day out with just no evidence whatsoever.
Well, Shannon O'Neill, let me turn back to you then, because, okay, so in this case, though, instead of supporting covert operations, the United States is being very open in its approach to what it would like to see happen in Venezuela. Again, with its throwing its support behind Guaido, these sanctions, which could be very damaging as well. So is this actually an improvement in how the U.S. is approaching the region, or specifically Venezuela?
You know, you have seen over the last several decades or a couple of decades a move away from this covert that the caller was referring to. And that was some of the history of the United States and Latin America, particularly during the Cold War. You've seen it move to overt. You've seen it to, here we see punitive in sanctions, but in other times we've seen it with grants through the U.S. State Department, USAID, types of funding for justice reform, for all kinds of things that we, when we're promoting democracy, when we're trying to deal with drug issues, our cooperation and money that goes to changes that we think will help Latin America and help the U.S.-Latin America cooperation. So I do think we have seen that move. I personally think that is better. It is an overt cooperation and working together between countries. Sometimes it's very positive. Other times it's over very difficult issues and there's tensions around it. But there you can, as a U.S. citizen or as a citizen of those countries, you can see what the governments are doing and you can agree or not agree. Now we turn here to the Trump administration. Now we have a much more aggressive and punitive
connection here or relationship. One, we've seen the recognition of a de jure government, but not a de facto one, right? Mm-hmm. They're not controlling anything on the ground. And then you've seen these sanctions, which are going to have severe ramifications for the regime, but also, we can't forget, for the Venezuelan economy, for the people who are living in Venezuela today.
Right. Well, let's go to Dan, who's calling from Canaan, New Hampshire. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So I just wanted to address whether the United States should be intervening with Venezuela. I think it's very important to listen to the people of Venezuela. You've got this young man who has so boldly stepped out on a limb here to try to take his country back for his people, and he's saying, we would like your help, but we don't want you to intervene. And, you know, I saw a program, a documentary type of program the other day of these two soldiers who had defected because they are backing him, but they have to leave so they don't, you know, get arrested and detained. And they also are saying, we don't want a military action against our country. We would like help, but please don't come in here guns blazing. And I think the United States can't really differentiate maybe between helping and intervening. And boy, sometimes I just wish we knew the difference.
Right. Dan, thank you for your call. Francisco Toro, pick up on that. It's a provocative way of framing it. Dan saying that the U.S. can't tell the difference between helping and intervening.
Well, the way I see it, the United States has been intervening every single day for the last 20 years simply because the main flows of money that keep the regime in power are from U.S. oil sales. So the U.S. doesn't have the luxury to sit it out. The U.S. is involved in this just as a commercial reality. So I think intervention shouldn't be, it needn't be military intervention. I think cutting off the flow of funds to the regime is intervention, and it's a badly needed and overdue intervention.
Mm. Let's go to Sam, who's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. My question cannot actually be thrown without recalling our national security apparatus 2 days ago or a day ago, sat down and analyzed who, where are threats to our nation coming from. Venezuela was not on the list. Iran was not on the list. Neither. This is on the other downside, on the higher side. Those who murder, kidnap, you know, a journalist, decapitate, kill, slaughter, cut like meat. Go in, we do business with them.
He's talking about Saudi Arabia there, Sam.
Well, absolutely. Every person knows what I'm talking about. The point is that, and we are pointing, for example, you have, you know, a Saudi on one side. You have one Iran on the one side. Our government, you know, admits that, you know, Iran is not a threat to us. But your point is, we're fixed on that.
Mm.
And then neglecting, turning down an authoritarian, you know, jihadist, you know, nation that has been, I mean, you can call the list.
Well, Sam, I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you for your call. Shannon O'Neill, yet another caller there, saying that, just sort of pointing out what they see as hypocrisy in the behavior of the United States government regarding authoritarian regimes around the world. Point taken. But Shannon, I also wanted to ask you, both you and Francisco, about other nations in the region, in South America. Certainly they are not happy at all with the instability in Venezuela right now.
Well, I think that's an important point. And here, you know, you look at the past, and one of the criticisms, and often justified criticism, of the U.S. is the heavy hand that we've had in various countries, Latin America, but others that the caller was talking about. But often it was unilateral. Often the United States was alone. And what's very striking about this moment vis-a-vis Venezuela is it's not just the United States. It's almost every government in the big countries in Latin America that are part of it. Canada is there. We will likely see the European Union get closer, as Maduro has said he's not holding elections. They said they won't recognize him by the end of this week if he doesn't hold elections. So you are seeing many nations around the world choose Guaido over Maduro. So this is not just a U.S. moment or a U.S. intervention. It is something that is much broader. And frankly, it's the Latin American neighbors, the countries around Venezuela, that one probably have more influence and sway with this government. These are his colleagues and comrades and counterparts. But two, they're also the countries that are being most affected by the instability in Venezuela, and particularly the refugees that have been leaving Venezuela. And so right now we are seeing over 3 million Venezuelans who have left the country. This is, you know, historic levels, probably the biggest refugee and fastest moving refugee crisis in the Western Hemisphere that we've seen. And it's these governments that are having to deal with this aftermath from the Maduro regime.
And Francisco Toro, your view on the need for regional stability?
Well, Latin America has changed. Sometimes I get the sense that people's stereotypes about Latin America are stuck in a kind of 1970s, 80s time warp. The region is democratic. Every country in South America except Venezuela right now has a democratically elected government. And democratic norms have spread throughout the region and have been solidifying throughout the region. So things that were once normal are no longer normal. And things that used to be acceptable are no longer acceptable. So what we've seen is the hemisphere as a whole coming together. And we talk about the U.S. a lot. It's really Peru and Canada that took the initiative to bring together a group of every big democracy in Latin America and create this Lima group that has been leading and pushing the fight to recognize Guaido and to push back against the installation of a new dictatorship in Latin America. Times have changed. Latin America is not prepared to accept things that seemed normal a generation ago.
Well, let's see if we can sneak in one last caller here quickly. Selena is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hello, my name is Elena Blanco, and about 15 years ago, I supported the Bolivarian Revolution, thinking that, you know, because we needed a lot of changes in Venezuela at that time, because there was a lot of inequalities. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, I went back to Venezuela. I've been working. I actually co-founded an organization in the Venezuelan Andes called Fundación Cultivar, and I've been working very close with communities, rural communities, and I have seen, like, firsthand the destruction of this regime throughout all the population, in the rural sectors, also the universities, you know, at all different sectors. Retired professors are going back to save the ULA, our University of the Andes. And the same thing is happening in Caracas and all throughout Venezuela, especially professors who are working at hospitals. So we're in a very daring situation. And I think it's a luxury for, you know, support for people to say, don't intervene. We're not asking for, you know, an intervention, really. We just want a regime change. And, you know, we need the support of, like, a big guy. Venezuelans, we have been doing a lot of work.
Yeah.
I participated, like, with many people in the protest. But, you know, we need support from abroad, because this is not just about, there are a lot of arms involved, and we need support.
Well, Selena, thank you so much for your call. And we just have just under a minute left there. Shannon O'Neill, you heard Selena saying she was once a Bolivarian, but now clearly opposed to the regime of Nicolas Maduro. In the last 30 seconds we have left here, Maduro has said that he's open to dialogue, but he's not going to hold, or has he refused to hold new presidential elections until 2025? So where does that leave us right now? Just got a couple of seconds.
You know, I think from what Selena was saying, you know, Chavez in the beginning, he had the diagnosis right, the challenges of poverty and inequality that Venezuela faced. But the solution we've seen has been disastrous. And Maduro said he's not going to change the path, at least so far. So we'll see if he's able to stand up against this international condemnation, but also the sanctions and other things that have come and may be coming.
Well, Shannon O'Neill, Vice President and Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Shannon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Francisco Toro, Venezuelan journalist and political scientist, editor of the online journal Caracas Chronicles, and contributor to The Washington Post as well. Francisco, thank you so much for your participation today. Much appreciated.
That was great.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.